41. Gage was buried at 2 o'clock that afternoon. By then the rain had stopped. Tattered clouds still moved overhead, and most of the mourners arrived carrying black umbrellas provided by the undertaker. At Rachel's request, the funeral director, who officiated at the short, non-sectarian graveside service, read the passage from Matthew, which begins, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." Lewis, standing on one side of the grave, looked across at his father-in-law. For a moment, Goldman looked back at him, and then he dropped his eyes. There was no fight left in him today. The pouches under his eyes now resembled mailbags, and around his black silk skullcap, hair as fine and white as tattered spiderwebs flew randomly in the breeze. With his grayish-black beard scragging his cheeks, he looked more like a wino than ever. He gave Lewis the impression of a man who did not really know where he was. Lewis tried, but could still find no pity in his heart for him. Gage's small white coffin, its latch presumably repaired, sat on a pair of chromed runners over the grave liner. The verges of the grave had been carpeted with astroturf, so violently green it hurt Lewis's eyes. Several baskets of flowers had been set on top of this artificial and strangely gay surface. Lewis's eyes looked over the funeral director's shoulder. Here was a low hill covered with graves, family plots, one Romanesque monument with the name Phipps engraved on it. Just above the sloping roof of Phipps, he could see a sliver of yellow. Lewis looked at this, pondering it. He continued to look at it even after the funeral director said, "Let us bow our heads for a moment of silent prayer." It took Lewis a few minutes, but he got it. It was a payloader. A payloader parked over the hill where the mourners wouldn't have to look at it. And when the funeral was over, Oz would crush his cigarette on the heel of his terrible work boot, put it in whatever container he carried around with him. In a cemetery, sextons caught depositing their butts on the ground were almost always summarily fired. It looked bad. Too many of the clientele had died of lung cancer. Jump in the payloader, fire that sucker up, and cut his son off from the sun forever, or at least until the day of the resurrection. Resurrection. Ah, there's a word that you should put right the fuck out of your mind, and you know it. When the funeral director said amen, Lewis took Rachel's arm and guided her away. Rachel murmured some protest. She wanted to stay a bit longer, please, Lewis. But Lewis was firm. They approached the cars. He saw the funeral director taking umbrellas with the home's name discreetly printed on the handles from the mourners who passed and handing them to an assistant. The assistant put them in an umbrella stand, which looked surreal, standing there on the dewy turf. He held Rachel's arm with his right hand and Ellie's white-gloved hand with his left. Ellie was wearing the same dress she had worn to Norma Crandall's funeral. Judd came over as Lewis handed his ladies into the car. Judd also looked as if he'd had a hard night. "You okay, Lewis?" Lewis nodded. Judd bent to look into the car. "How are you, Rachel?" he asked.
"I'm all right, Judd," she whispered.
Judd touched her shoulder gently and then looked at Ellie.
"How about you, dear one?"
"I'm fine," Ellie said and produced a hideous smile of shark-like proportions to show him how fine she was.
"What's that picture you got there?"
For a moment, Lewis thought she would hold it, refused to show him, and then, with a painful shyness, she passed it to Judd. He held it in his big fingers, fingers that were so splayed and somehow clumsy-looking, fingers that looked fit mostly for grappling with the transmissions of big road machines or making couplings on the B&M line. But they were also the fingers that had pulled a bee stinger from Gage's neck with all the offhand skill of a magician. Or a surgeon.
"Why, that's real nice," Judd said. "You pulling him on a sled. But he liked that, didn't he, Ellie?"
Beginning to weep, Ellie nodded. Rachel began to say something, but Lewis squeezed her arm. "Be still a while."
"I used to pull him a lot," Ellie said, weeping. "And he'd laugh and laugh. Then we'd go in and Mommy would fix us cocoa and say, 'Put your boots away.'
And Gage would grab them all up and scream, "Boots, boots," so loud it hurt your ears. Remember that, Mom?
Rachel nodded.
"Yeah, I bet that was a good time, all right," Judd said, handing the picture back.
"And he may be dead now, Ellie, but you can keep your memories of him."
"I'm going to," she said, wiping at her face. "I loved Gage, Mr. Crandall."
"I know you did, dear."
He leaned in and kissed her, and when he withdrew, his eyes swept Lewis and Rachel stonily. Rachel met his gaze, puzzled and a little hurt, not understanding. But Lewis understood well enough.
"What are you doing for her?" Judd's eyes asked. "Your son is dead, but your daughter is not. What are you doing for her?"
Lewis looked away. There was nothing he could do for her, not yet. She would have to swim in her grief as best she could. His thoughts were too full of his son.
42. By evening, a fresh rack of clouds had come in, and a strong west wind had begun to blow. Lewis put on his light jacket, zipped it up, and took the Civic keys from the peg on the wall.
"Where are you going, Lou?" Rachel asked. She spoke without much interest. After supper, she had begun crying again, and although her weeping was gentle, she had seemed incapable of stopping. Lewis had forced her to take a Valium. Now she sat with the paper folded open to the barely started crossword puzzle. In the other room, Ellie sat silently watching Little House on the Prairie, with Gage's picture on her lap.
"I thought I'd pick up a pizza. Didn't you get enough to eat earlier?"
"I just didn't seem hungry then," he said, telling the truth, and then adding a lie. "I am now."
That afternoon, between 3 and 6, the final rite of Gage's funeral had taken place at the Ludlow house. This was the rite of food. Steve Masterton and his wife had come with a hamburger and noodle casserole. Charlton had appeared with a quiche. "It will keep until you want it, if it doesn't all get eaten," she told Rachel. "Quiche is easy to warm up." The Danikers, from up the road, brought a baked ham. The Goldmans appeared. Neither of them would speak to Lewis or even come close to him, for which he was not sorry, with a variety of cold cuts and cheeses. Judd also brought cheese, a large wheel of his old favorite, Mr. Rat. Missy Dandridge brought a key lime pie, and Surendra Hardu brought apples. The rite of food apparently transcended religious differences. This was the funeral party, and although it was quiet, it was not quite subdued. There was rather less drinking than at an ordinary party, but there was some. After a few beers, only the night before he had sworn he would never touch the stuff again, but in the cold afternoon light the previous evening had seemed impossibly long ago, Lewis thought to pass on a few little funerary anecdotes his Uncle Carl had told him. That at Sicilian funerals, unmarried women sometimes snipped a piece of the deceased's shroud and slept with it under their pillows, believing it would bring them luck in love. That at Irish funerals, mock weddings were sometimes performed, and the toes of the dead were tied together because of an ancient Celtic belief that it kept the deceased's ghost from walking. Uncle Carl said that the custom of tying DOA tags to the great toes of corpses had begun in New York, and since all of the early morgue keepers had been Irish, he believed this to be a survival of that old superstition. Then, looking at their faces, he decided such tales would be taken wrong. Rachel had broken down only once, and her mother was there to comfort her. Rachel clung to Dory Goldman and sobbed against her shoulder in an open, let-it-all-go way that had been so far impossible for her with Lewis, perhaps because she saw them both as culpable in Gage's death, or perhaps because Lewis, lost in the peculiar half-world of his own fancies, had not encouraged her grief. Either way, she had turned to her mother for comfort, and Dory was there to give it, mingling her tears with her daughter's. Irwin Goldman stood behind them, his hand on Rachel's shoulder, and looked with sickly triumph across the room at Lewis. Ellie circulated with a silver tray loaded with canapes, little rolls with a feathered toothpick poked through each one. Her picture of Gage was tucked firmly under her arm. Lewis received condolences. He nodded and thanked the condolers. And if his eyes seemed distant, his manner a little cold, people supposed he was thinking of the past, of the accident,
of the gageless life ahead. None, perhaps not even Judd, would have suspected that Lewis had begun to think about the strategies of grave robbing. Only in an academic way, of course. It was not that he intended to do anything. It was only a way to keep his mind occupied. It was not as if he intended to do anything. Lewis stopped at the Orrington Corner store, bought 2 6-packs of cold beer, and called ahead to Napoli's for a pepperoni and mushroom pizza. "Want to give me a name on that, sir?" Oz, the Great and Terrible, Lewis thought. Lou Creed. "Okay, Lou, we're real busy, so it'll be maybe 45 minutes. That okay for you?" "Sure," Lewis said and hung up. As he got back into the Civic and keyed the engine, it occurred to him that although there were maybe 20 pizza joints in the Bangor area, he had picked the one closest to Pleasant View, where Gage was buried. "Well, what the hell," he thought uneasily. "They make good pizza. No frozen dough. Throw it up and catch it on your fists, right there where you can watch. And Gage used to laugh." He cut that thought off. He drove past Napoli's to Pleasant View. He supposed he had known that he would do that, but what harm? None. He parked across the street and crossed the road to the wrought iron gates which glimmered in the final light of day. Above them, in a semicircle, were wrought iron letters spelling Pleasant View. The view was, in Lewis's mind, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. The cemetery was nicely landscaped on several rolling hills. There were long aisles of trees. Ah, but in these last few minutes of fading daylight, the shadows those trees threw seemed deeply pooled and as blackly unpleasant as still quarry water. And a few isolated weeping willows. It wasn't quiet. The turnpike was near. The drone of traffic came on the steady, chill wind. And the glow in the darkening sky was Bangor International Airport. He stretched his hand out to the gate, thinking, they'll be locked. But they were not. Perhaps it was too early to lock them, and if they locked them at all, it would only be to protect the place against drunks, vandals, and teenage neckers. The days of the Dickensian resurrection men, there's that word again, were over. The right-hand gate swung in with a faint screeing noise, and after a glance over his shoulder to make sure he was unobserved, Lewis stepped through. He closed the gate behind him and heard the click of the latch. He stood in this modest suburb of the dead, looking around. A fine and private place, he thought. But none, I think, do there embrace. Who? Andrew Marvel? And why did the human mind store up such amazing middens of useless junk anyway? Judd's voice spoke up in his mind then, worried and frightened? Yes, frightened. Lewis, what are you doing here? You're looking up a road you don't want to travel. He pushed the voice aside. If he was torturing anyone, it was only himself. No one need know he had been here as the daylight wound down to the dark. He began to walk toward Gage's grave, taking one of the winding paths. In a moment he was in a lane of trees. They rustled their new leaves mysteriously over his head. His heart was thudding too loudly in his chest. The graves and monuments were in rough rows. Somewhere there would be a caretaker's building, and in it would be a map of Pleasant View's 20 or so acres, neatly and sanely divided into quadrants, each quadrant showing the occupied graves and the unsold plots. Real estate for sale. One-room apartments. Sleepers. Not much like the pet cemetery, he thought, and this caused him to stop and consider for a moment, surprised. No, it wasn't. The pet cemetery had given him an impression of order, rising almost unknown out of chaos. Those rough, concentric circles moving inward to the center, rude slates, crosses made out of boards, as if the children who buried their pets there had created the pattern out of their own collective unconsciousness, as if... For a moment, Lewis saw the pet cemetery as a kind of advertisement. A come-on, like the kind they gave you on Freak Alley at the carnival. They'd bring out the fire-eater, and you got to watch his show for free because the owners knew you wouldn't buy the steak unless you saw the sizzle. You wouldn't cough up the cash if you didn't see the flash. Those graves. those graves in their almost druidic circles. The graves in the pet cemetery mimed the most ancient religious symbol of all, diminishing circles indicating a spiral leading down not to a point, but to infinity. Order from chaos, or chaos from order, depending on which way your mind worked. It was a symbol the Egyptians had chiseled on the tombs of the pharaohs, a symbol the Phoenicians had drawn on the barrows of their fallen kings. It was found on cave walls in ancient Mycenae. The guild kings of Stonehenge had created it as a clock to time the universe. It appeared in the Judeo-Christian Bible as the whirlwind from which God had spoken to Job. The spiral was the oldest sign of power in the world, man's oldest symbol of that twisty bridge which may exist between the world and the gulf. Lewis reached Gage's grave at last. The payloader was gone. The astroturf had been removed, rolled up by some whistling workman with his mind on an after-work beer at the Fairmount Lounge, stored in an equipment shed somewhere. Where Gage lay, there was a neat rectangle of bare, raked earth, perhaps 5 feet by 3 feet. The headstone had not been set up yet. Lewis kneeled. The wind blew through his hair, tumbling it. The sky was almost entirely dark now. It raced with clouds. No one has shone a light in my face and asked me what I'm doing here. No watchdog has barked. The gate was unlocked. The days of the resurrection man are past. If I came up here with a pick and a shovel... He came back to himself with a jerk. He was only playing a dangerous mind game with himself if he pretended that Pleasant View stood unwatched during the night hours. Suppose he was discovered belly deep in his son's new grave by the caretaker or the watchman. It might not get into the papers, but then again it might. He might be charged with a crime. What crime? Grave robbing? Unlikely. Malicious mischief or vandalism would be more likely. And in the paper or out of it, the word would get around. People would talk. It was a story too juicy not to be told. Local doctor is discovered digging up his 2-year-old son, recently killed in a tragic road accident. He would lose his job. Even if not, Rachel would be chilled by the wind of such tales, and Ellie might be harried by them at school until her life was a misery of chanting children. There might be the humiliation of a sanity test in exchange for dropping charges. But if I could bring Gage back to life, Gage could live again. Did he really, actually, believe that? The fact was that he did. He had told himself time and time again, both before Gage's death and after it, that Church had not really been dead, only stunned. That Church had dug his way out and come home. A kiddie story with gruesome undertones. Winnie the Pooh. Master unwittingly piles a cairn of stones over a living animal. Faithful beast digs itself out and comes home. Fine. Except it was not true. Church had been dead. The Micmac burying ground had brought it back to life. He sat by Gage's grave, trying to place all the known components in an order as rational and logical as this dark magic would allow. Timmy Baderman now. First, did he believe the story? And second, did it make a difference? In spite of its convenience, he believed most of it. It was undeniable that if a place like the Micmac burying ground existed, as it did, and if people knew of it, as a few of the older Ludlowites did, then sooner or later someone would try the experiment. Human nature, as Lewis understood it, made it more difficult to believe that it had stopped at a few pets and valuable breed animals. All right, then. Did he also believe that Timmy Baderman had been transformed into some sort of all-knowing demon? That was a more difficult question, and he was wary of it because he didn't want to believe it. And he had seen the results of that sort of mindset before. No, he did not want to believe Timmy Baderman had been a demon. But he would not, absolutely could not, allow himself to let what he wanted cloud his judgment. Lewis thought about Hanratty, the bull. Hanratty, Judd said, had turned mean. So, in his way, had Timmy Baderman. Hanratty had later been put down by the same man who had somehow dragged the bull's body up to the Mi'kmaq burying ground on a sledge. Timmy Baterman had been put down by his father. But because Hanratty had gone bad, did that mean that all animals went bad? No. Hanratty the bull did not prove the general case. Hanratty was, in fact, an exception to the general case. Look back at the other animals. Judd's dog Spot, the old woman's parakeet, Church himself. They'd all come back changed. Now, the change had been noticeable in all cases. But in the case of Spot, at least, the change hadn't been so great that Judd had forborne to recommend the process of resurrection. Yes, of resurrection to a friend years later. Of course, farther down the line, he had tried to justify and hem and haw, and had spouted a lot of ominous, confused bullshit that could not even rightly be called philosophy. How could he refuse to take the chance available to him? This one unbelievable chance on the basis of the Timmy Baterman story. One swallow did not a summer make. You're slanting all the evidence in favor of the conclusion you want to produce, his mind protested. At least tell yourself the goddamn truth about the change in Church. Even if you want to disqualify the animals, the mice and the birds, what about the way he is? Muddled. That's the best word of all. That sums it up. The day we were out with the kite. You remember how Gage was that day? How vibrant and alive he was, reacting to everything? Wouldn't it be better to remember him that way? You want to resurrect the zombie from a grade B horror picture? Or even something so prosaic as a retarded little boy? A boy who eats with his fingers and stares blankly at images on the TV screen and who will never learn to write his own name? What did Judd say about his dog? It was like washing a piece of meat. Is that what you want? A piece of breathing meat? And even if you're able to be satisfied with that, how do you explain the return of your son from the dead to your wife, to your daughter, to Steve Masterton, to the world? What happens the first time Missy Dandridge pulls into the driveway and sees Gage riding his trike in the yard? Can't you hear her screams, Lewis? Can't you see her harrowing her face with her fingernails? What do you say to the reporters? What do you say when a film crew from real people turns up on your doorstep wanting to shoot film of your resurrected son? Did any of this really matter, or was it only the voice of cowardice? Did he believe these things could not be dealt with? That Rachel would greet her dead son with anything but tears of joy? Yes, he supposed there was a real possibility that Gage might return, well, diminished. But would that change the quality of his love? Parents loved children who were born blind, children born as Siamese twins, children who were born with their guts abysmally rearranged. Parents pled for judicial mercy or executive clemency on behalf of children who had grown up to commit rape and murder and the torture of the innocent. Did he believe it would be impossible for him to love Gage even if Gage had to go on wearing diapers until he was 8? If he did not master the first grade primer until he was 12? If he never mastered it at all? Could he simply dismiss his son as a sort of divine abortion when there was another recourse? But Lewis, my God, you don't live in a vacuum. People will say, he cut that thought off with rude, angry force. Of all the things not to consider now, public notice was probably the greatest of them. Lewis glanced down at the raked dirt of Gage's grave and felt a wave of awe and horror course through him. Unknowing, moving by themselves, his fingers had drawn a pattern in the dirt. He had drawn a spiral. He swept the fingers of both hands through the dirt, rubbing the pattern out. Then he left Pleasant View, hurrying, feeling very much a trespasser now, believing that he would be seen, stopped, questioned at every turn of the path. He was late collecting his pizza, and although it had been left on top of one of the big ovens, it was semi-cold and greasy and every bit as tasty as cooked clay. Lewis ate one piece and then tossed the rest out the window, box and all, as he headed back to Ludlow. He wasn't a litter bug by nature, but he did not want Rachel to see a mostly uneaten pizza at home in the wastebasket. It might raise a surmise in her mind that a pizza wasn't really what he'd had in mind when he went to Bangor. Lewis now began to think about the time and circumstance. Time. Time might be of extreme, even crucial, importance. Timmy Baterman had been dead a good while before his father could get him up to the Micmac burying ground. Timmy was shot the 19th. Timmy was buried, don't hold me to this, but I think it was July 22nd. It was 4 or 5 days later that Marjorie Washburn saw Timmy walking up the road. All right, say that Bill Baterman had done it 4 days after his son's original interral. No. If he was going to err, let him err on the side of conservatism. Say, 3 days. For the sake of argument, assume that Timmy Baterman returned from the dead on July 25th. That made 6 days between the boy's death and his return, and that was a conservative estimate. It might have been as long as 10 days. For Gage, it had now been 4 days. Time had already gotten away from him to a degree, but it was still possible to cut Bill Baterman's best time considerably. If he could bring about circumstances similar to those which had made the resurrection of Church possible. Because Church had died at the best possible time, hadn't he? His family had been away when Church was struck and killed. No one was the wiser except for him and Judd. His family had been in Chicago. For Lewis, the final piece fell into place with a neat little click. "You want us to what?" Rachel asked, staring at him, astounded. It was 10:15. Ellie had gone to bed. Rachel had taken another Valium after cleaning up the detritus of the funeral party. Funeral party was another of those horrible phrases full of unstated paradox, like visiting hours. But there seemed no other phrase for the way they had spent their afternoon. And it seemed dazed and quiet ever since he returned from Bangor. But this had gotten through. "To go back to Chicago with your mother and father," Lewis repeated patiently. "They'll be going tomorrow. If you call them now, and Delta right after, you may be able to get on the same plane with them." "Lewis, have you lost your mind? After the fight you had with my father..." Lewis found himself speaking with a quick glibness that was totally unlike him. It afforded him a cheesy sort of exhilaration. He felt like a football sub who suddenly gets the ball and makes a 70-yard touchdown run, cutting and weaving, outthinking potential tacklers with a delirious, one-time-only ease. He had never been a particularly good liar, and he had not planned this encounter in any detail at all. But now a string of plausible lies, half-truths, and inspired justification poured out of him. "The fight we had is one of the reasons I want you and Ellie to go back with them. It's time we sewed up this wound, Rachel." "I knew that. Felt it. At the funeral parlor. When the fight started, I was trying to patch things up. But this trip... I don't think it's a good idea at all, Lewis. We need you. And you need us." Her eyes measured him doubtfully. "At least I hope you need us. And neither of us are in any shape to..." "In any kind of shape to stay here," Lewis said forcefully. He felt as if he might be coming down with a fever. "I'm glad you need me, and I do need you and Ellie, but right now this is the worst damn place in the world for you, honey. Gage is everywhere in this house, around every corner. For you and me, sure. But it's even worse for Ellie, I think." He saw pain flicker in her eyes and knew he had touched her. Some part of himself felt shame at this cheap victory. All the textbooks he'd read on the subject of death told him that the bereaved's first strong impulse is to get away from the place where it happened, and that to succumb to such an impulse may turn out to be the most harmful course of action, because it allows the bereaved the dubious luxury of refusing to come to terms with the new reality. The books said it was best to remain where you were, to battle grief on its home ground until it subsided into remembrance. But Lewis simply did not dare make the experiment with his family at home. He had to get rid of them, at least for a while. "I know," she said. "It just hits you all over the place. I moved the couch while you were in Bangor. I thought, Running the vacuum around would take my mind off things. And I found four of his little matchbox cars under there, as if they were waiting for him to come back and, you know, play with them. Her voice, already wavering, now broke. Tears spilled down her cheeks. And that's when I took the second Valium, because I started crying again, the way I'm crying now. Oh, what a fucking soap opera all of this is. Hold me, Lou. Will you hold me? He did hold her, and he did it well. But he felt like an imposter. His mind spun with ways to turn these tears to his further benefit. Some nice guy, all right. Hey-ho, let's go. How long does it go on? She wept. Does it ever end? If only we could have him back, Louis. I swear I'd watch him better. It would never happen. And just because that driver was going too fast, that doesn't let me, us, off the hook. I didn't know there could ever be hurt like this. And that's the truth. It comes. Over and over it comes, and it hurts so much, Louis. There's no rest from it even when I go to sleep. When I go to sleep, I dream it over and over again. I see him running to the road, and I scream to him, "Shh," he said, "Rachel, shh." She lifted her puffy face to him. It wasn't even as if he were being bad, Louis. It was just a game to him. The truck came at the wrong time, and Missy Dandridge called while I was still crying, and said she read in the Ellsworth American that the driver tried to kill himself. What? He tried to hang himself in his garage. He's in shock and deep depression, the paper said. Too fucking bad he didn't make good on it, Louis said savagely. But his voice sounded distant to his own ears, and he felt a chill spreading through. The place has a power, Louis. It's been full of power before, and I'm scared it's coming round to full again. My boy's dead, and he's out on $1,000 bail. And he'll go on feeling depressed and suicidal until some judge takes away his license for 90 days and gives him a slap-on-the-wrist fine. Missy says his wife has taken the kids and left him, Rachel said dully. She didn't get that from the paper, but from somebody who knows somebody down Ellsworth way. He wasn't drunk. He wasn't on drugs. He didn't have any previous speeding violations. He said that when he got to Ludlow, he just felt like putting the pedal to the metal. He said he didn't even know why. So round and around it goes. He just felt like putting the pedal to the metal. The place has a power. Louis thrust these thoughts away. He gripped his wife's forearm gently. Call your mother and father. Do it now. There's no need for you and Ellie to be in this house another day. Not another day. Not without you, she said. Louis, I want us, I need us to stick together. I'll follow you in 3 days, 4 at the most. If things went well, Rachel and Ellie might be back here in 48 hours. I've got to find someone to fill in for me on a part-time basis, at least at the university. I've got sick time and vacation time coming, but I don't want to leave Surrendra on the hot seat. Judd can watch the house while we're gone, but I'll want to cut off the electricity and store what we've got in the Dandridge's deep freeze. Ellie's school? The hell with it. It's out in 3 weeks anyway. They'll understand, the circumstances being what they are. They'll arrange an early dismissal. It'll all work just... Louis? He broke off. What? What are you hiding?
Hiding?
He looked at her openly, clearly.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Don't you?
No, I don't.
Never mind. I'll call them right now, if that's what you really want.
It is, he said, and the words seemed to echo in his mind with an iron clang.
It might even be best for Ellie. She looked at him with her red-rimmed eyes, still slightly glazed from Valium. You look feverish, Louis, as if you might be coming down with something. She went to the telephone and called the motel where her parents were staying before Louis could reply. The Goldmans were overjoyed at Rachel's proposal. They were not so wild about the idea of Louis joining them in 3 or 4 days, but in the end, they wouldn't have to worry about it at all, of course. Louis had not the slightest intention of going to Chicago. He had suspected that if there was to be a snag, it would be getting air reservations this late. But luck was with him there, too. There were still available seats on Delta's Bangor to Cincinnati run, and a quick check showed 2 cancellations on a Cincinnati to Chicago flight. It meant that Rachel and Ellie would be able to travel with the Goldmans only as far as Cincinnati, but they would get to Chicago less than an hour after.
It's almost like magic, Lewis thought, hanging up the telephone, and Judd's voice responded promptly.
It's been full of power before, and I'm a scared...
Oh, get fucked, he told Judd's voice rudely. I've learned to accept a great many strange things in the last 10 months, my good old friend. But am I ready to believe that a haunted patch of ground can influence airline ticketing? I don't think so.
I'll have to pack, Rachel said. She was looking at the flight information Lewis had jotted down on the pad by the phone.
Take just the 1 big suitcase, Lewis said.
She looked at him, wide-eyed, mildly startled.
For both of us? Lewis, you're joking.
All right, take a couple of tote bags, too, but don't exhaust yourself packing a different outfit for the next 3 weeks, he said, thinking, especially since you may be back in Ludlow very soon.
Take enough for a week, 10 days. You've got the checkbook and the credit cards. Buy what you need.
But we can't afford... she began doubtfully. She seemed doubtful about everything now, malleable, easily confused. He remembered her odd dangling comment about the Winnebago he had once spoken idly about buying.
We have the money, he said.
Well, I suppose we could use Gage's college fund if we needed to, although it would take a day or two to process the savings account and a week to get the treasury bills cashed.
Her face began to crumple and dissolve again. Lewis held her.
She's right. It just keeps right on hitting you. It never lets up.
Rachel, don't, he said. Don't cry.
But of course, she did. She had to. While she was upstairs packing, the phone rang. Lewis sprang for it, thinking it would be someone from Delta ticketing, saying a mistake had been made. No flights were available.
I should have known everything was going too smoothly.
But it wasn't Delta ticketing. It was Irwin Goldman.
I'll get Rachel, Lewis said.
No.
For a moment, there was nothing else, only silence.
He's probably sitting there trying to decide which name to call you first.
When Goldman spoke again, his voice was strained. He seemed to be pushing the words out against some great inner resistance.
It's you I want to talk to. Dury wanted me to call and apologize for my behavior. Lewis, I guess I wanted to apologize, too.
Why, Irwin, how big of you. My God, I think I just wet my pants.
You don't need to apologize, Lewis said. His voice was dry and mechanical. What I did was inexcusable, Goldman said.
Now he did not just seem to be pushing the words out. He seemed to be coughing them out.
You suggesting that Rachel and Eileen come out has made me see what a big man you have been about this, and how small I have been.
There was something very familiar in this rap, something eerily familiar. Then he got it, and his mouth suddenly pulled together in a tight pucker, as if he had bitten straight through a plump yellow lemon. Rachel's way, she was completely unaware of it, Lewis was sure, of saying contritely, Lewis, I'm sorry I was such a bitch, after her bitchiness had gotten her own way about something she really wanted. Here was that voice, robbed of Rachel's liveliness and merriness, true, but that same voice saying, I'm sorry I was such a bastard, Lewis. The old man was getting his daughter and granddaughter back. They were running home from Maine to Daddy. Courtesy of Delta and United, they were coming back to where they belonged, back to where Irwin Goldman wanted them. Now he could afford to be magnanimous. As far as old Irwin knew, he had won.
So let's just forget that I took a swing at you over your dead son's body, Lewis, or that I kicked you when you were down, or that I knocked his coffin off its bier and snapped the latch so you could see or think you saw that one last flash of your child's hand. Let's forget all of that. Let bygones be bygones.
Terrible as that may be, Irwin, you old prick, I wish for you to drop dead right this second, if it wouldn't screw up my plans.
That's all right, Mr. Goldman, he said evenly. It was, well,
an emotional day for all of us.
It was not all right, he persisted, and Lewis realized, although he did not want to, that Goldman was not just being political, not just saying that he was sorry he had been such a bastard now that he was getting his own way. The man was nearly weeping, and he was speaking with a slow and trembling urgency.
It was a terrible day for all of us. Thanks to me. Thanks to a stupid, bullheaded old man. I hurt my daughter when she needed my help. I hurt you, and maybe you needed my help too, Lewis. That you do this, behave this way, after I behaved that way, it makes me feel like garbage, and I think that is just the way I should feel.
Oh, let him stop this. Let him stop before I start to scream at him and blow the whole deal.
Rachel's probably told you, Lewis. We had another daughter.
Zelda, Lewis said.
Yes, she told me about Zelda.
It was difficult, Goldman said in that trembling voice. Difficult for all of us. Most difficult for Rachel, perhaps. Rachel was there when Zelda died. But difficult for Dory and me, too. Dory almost had a breakdown.
What do you think Rachel had? Lewis wanted to shout. Do you think a kid can't have a nervous breakdown? 20 years later, she's still jumping at death's shadow. And now this happens. This miserable, awful thing. It's a minor miracle that she isn't in the fucking hospital being fed through an IV tube. So don't talk to me about how difficult it was for you and your wife, you bastard.
Ever since Zelda died, we have... I suppose we have clung to Rachel, always wanting to protect her and to make it up to her, make up for the problems she had with her back for years afterward, make up for not being there.
Yes, the old man was really crying. Why did he have to be crying? It made it harder for Lewis to hold on to his clean, pure hate. More difficult, but not impossible. He deliberately called up the image of Goldman reaching into the pocket of his smoking jacket for his overflowing checkbook. But he suddenly saw Zelda Goldman in the background, an unquiet ghost in a stinking bed, her cheesy face full of spite and agony, her hands pulled into claws. The Goldman ghost. Oz, the great and terrible.
Please, he said. Please, Mr. Goldman. Irwin, no more. Let's not make things any worse than they have to be, okay? I believe now that you are a good man, and that I misjudged you, Lewis.
Oh, listen, I know what you think. Am I that stupid?
No, stupid, but not that stupid.
You think I'm saying all of this because now I can. You're thinking, oh, yeah, he's getting what he wants, and once he tried to buy me off, but,
Lewis, I swear...
No more, Lewis said gently. I really can't take any more. Now his voice was trembling as well. Okay?
All right, Goldman said and sighed. Lewis thought it was a sigh of relief. But let me say again that I apologize. You don't have to accept it. But that is what I called to say, Lewis. I apologize.
All right, Lewis said. He closed his eyes. His head was thudding. Thank you, Irwin. Your apology is accepted.
Thank you, Goldman said. And thank you for letting them come. Perhaps it is what they both need. We'll wait for them at the airport.
Fine, Lewis said. And an idea suddenly occurred to him. It was crazy and attractive in its very sanity. He would let bygones be bygones. And he would let Gage lie in his Pleasant View grave. Instead of trying to reopen a door that had swung shut, he would latch it and double-bolt it and throw away the key. He would do just what he had told his wife he was going to, tidy up their affairs here and catch a plane back to Chi-Town. They would perhaps spend the entire summer there, he and his wife and his good-hearted daughter. They would go to the zoo and the planetarium and boating on the lake. He would take Ellie to the top of the Sears Tower and show her the Midwest stretching away like a great flat game board, rich and dreaming. Then, when mid-August came, they would come back to this house, which now seemed so sad and so shadowy, and perhaps it would be like starting over again. Perhaps they could begin weaving from fresh thread. What was on the Creed loom right now was ugly, splattered with drying blood. But would that not be the same as murdering his son, killing him a second time? A voice inside tried to argue that this was not so, but he would not listen. He shut the voice up briskly. "Erwin, I ought to go now. I want to make sure Rachel's got what she needs and then get her to bed." "All right. Goodbye, Lewis. And once more, if he says he's sorry one more time, I'll fucking scream." "Goodbye, Erwin," he said and hung up the phone. Rachel was deep in a litter of clothes when he came upstairs. Blouses on the beds, bras hung over the backs of chairs, slacks on hangers that had been hung over the doorknob. Shoes were lined up like soldiers under the window. She appeared to be packing slowly but competently. Lewis could see it was going to take her at least 3 suitcases, maybe 4. But he could also see no sense in arguing with her about it. Instead, he pitched in and helped. "Lewis," she said as they closed the last suitcase. He had to sit on it before Rachel could snap the catches. "Are you sure there's nothing you want to tell me?" "For God's sake, hon, what is this?" "I don't know what it is," she replied evenly. "That's why I'm asking." "What do you think I'm going to do? Creep off to a bordello? Join the circus? What?" "I don't know. But this feels wrong. It feels as if you're trying to get rid of us." "Rachel, that's ridiculous." He said this with a vehemence that was partly exasperation. Even in such straits as these, he felt a certain pique in being seen through so easily. She smiled wanly. "You never were a very good liar, Lou." He began to protest again, and she cut him off. "Ellie dreamed you were dead," she said, "last night. She woke up crying, and I went into her. I slept with her for 2 or 3 hours and then came back in with you. She said that in her dream you were sitting at the kitchen table, and your eyes were open, but she knew you were dead. She said she could hear Steve Masterton screaming." Lois looked at her, dismayed. "Rachel," he said at last, "her brother just died. It's normal enough for her to dream that other members of her family..." "Yes, I surmise that much for myself. But the way she told it, the elements, it seemed to me to have a quality of prophecy." She laughed weakly. "Or maybe you had to be there." "Yes, maybe so," Lewis said. "It seemed to me to have a quality of prophecy." "Come to bed with me," Rachel said. "The volume's all worn off, and I don't want to take any more. But I'm afraid. I've been having my own dreams." "Dreams of what?" "Of Zelda," she said simply. "The last few nights since Gage died, when I go to sleep, Zelda's there. She says she's coming for me, and this time she'll get me. That both she and Gage will get me for letting them die." "Rachel, that's..." "I know. Just a dream. Normal enough. But come to bed with me and keep the dreams away if you can, Lewis." They lay together in the dark, crowded into Lewis's single. "Rachel, you still awake?"
"Yes."
"I want to ask you something."
"Go ahead."
He hesitated, not wanting to cause her even more pain, but needing to know. "Do you remember the scare we had with him when he was 9 months old?" he asked finally.
"Yes. Yes, of course I do."
"Why?" By the time Gage was 9 months old, Lewis had become deeply concerned about his son's cranial size. It was right off Lewis's Bertier chart, which showed the normal range of infant head sizes on a per-month basis. At 4 months, Gage's skull size had begun to drift toward the highest part of the curve, and then it began to go even higher than that. He wasn't having any trouble holding his head up. That would have been a dead giveaway. But Lewis had nevertheless taken him to George Tardif, who was perhaps the best neurologist in the Midwest. Rachel had wanted to know what was wrong, and Lewis had told her the truth. He was worried that Gage might be hydrocephalic. Rachel's face had grown very white, but she had remained calm.
"He seems normal to me," she said.
Lewis nodded. "He does to me, too, but I don't want to ignore this, babe.
No, you mustn't, she said. We mustn't.
Tardif had measured Gage's skull and frowned. Tardif poked two fingers at Gage's face, Three Stooges style. Gage flinched. Tardif smiled. Lewis's heart thawed out a little. Tardif gave Gage a ball to hold. Gage held it for a while and then dropped it. Tardif retrieved the ball and bounced it, watching Gage's eyes. Gage's eyes tracked the ball.
I'd say there's a 50-50 chance he's hydrocephalic, Tardif said to Lewis in his office later.
No, the odds may actually be a bit higher than that. If so, it's mild. He seems very alert. The new shunt operation should take care of the problem easily, if there is a problem.
A shunt means brain surgery, Lewis said.
Minor brain surgery. Lewis had studied the process not long after he began to worry about the size of Gage's head. And the shunt operation, designed to drain excess fluid, had not looked very minor to him. But he kept his mouth shut, telling himself just to be grateful the operation existed at all.
Of course, Tardif went on, there's still a large possibility that your kid just has a real big head for a 9-month-old. I think a CAT scan is the best place to start. Do you agree?
Lewis had agreed. Gage spent a night in our Sisters of Charity hospital and underwent general anesthesia. His sleeping head was stuck into a gadget that looked like a giant clothes dryer. Rachel and Lewis waited downstairs, while Ellie spent the day at Grandma and Granddad's, watching Sesame Street nonstop on Granddad's new video recorder. For Lewis, those had been long, gray hours in which he found himself totting up sums of varying ugliness and comparing results. Death under general anesthesia. Death during a shunt operation. Mild retardation as a result of hydrocephalus. Cataclysmic retardation as a result of same. Epilepsy. Blindness. Oh, there were all sorts of possibilities.
For really complete disaster maps, Lewis remembered thinking, see your local doctor.
Tardif had come into the waiting room around 5 o'clock. He had 3 cigars. He plugged one into Lewis's mouth, one into Rachel's, she was too flabbergasted to protest, and one into his own. The kid is fine. No hydrocephalus.
Light this thing, Rachel had said, weeping and laughing at the same time. I'm going to smoke it till I puke.
Grinning, Tardif lit their cigars.
God was saving him for Route 15, Dr. Tardif, Lewis thought now.
Rachel, if he had been hydrocephalic, and if the shunt hadn't worked, could you have still loved him?
What a weird question, Lewis.
Could you?
Yes, of course. I would have loved Gage no matter what.
Even if he was retarded?
Yes.
Would you have wanted him institutionalized?
No, I don't think so, she said slowly. I suppose with the money you're making now, we could afford that. A really good place, I mean. But I think I'd want him with us, if we could.
Lewis, why do you ask?
Why, I suppose I was still thinking of your sister Zelda, he said.
He was still astonished at this eerie glibness. Wondering if you could have gone through that again.
It wouldn't have been the same, she said, sounding almost amused.
Gage was Gage. He was our son. That would have made all the difference.
It would have been hard, I guess, but would you have wanted him in an institution, a place like Pineland?
No.
Let's go to sleep.
That's a good idea.
I feel I can sleep now, she said. I want to put this day behind me.
Amen to that, Lewis said. A long time later, she said drowsily,
You're right, Lewis. Just dreams and vapors.
Sure, he said, and kissed her earlobe. Now sleep.
It seemed to me to have a quality of prophecy.
He did not sleep for a long time, and before he did, the curved bone of the moon looked in the window at him. 43.
The following day was overcast but very warm, and Lewis was sweating heavily by the time he had checked Rachel's and Ellie's baggage through and gotten their tickets out of the computer. He supposed just being able to keep busy was something of a gift, and he felt only a small, aching comparison to the last time he had put his family on a plane to Chicago at Thanksgiving. Ellie seemed distant and a trifle odd. Several times that morning, Lewis had looked up and seen an expression of peculiar speculation on her face.
Conspirator's complex working overtime, boyo, he told himself.
She said nothing when told they were all going to Chicago, she and Mommy first, perhaps for the whole summer, and only went on eating her breakfast, Cocoa Bears. After breakfast, she went silently upstairs and got into the dress and shoes Rachel had laid out for her. She had brought the picture of her pulling Gage on her sled to the airport with her, and she sat calmly in one of the plastic contour seats in the lower lobby while Lewis stood in line for their tickets and the loudspeaker blared intelligence of arriving and departing flights.
Mr. and Mrs. Goldman showed up 40 minutes before flight time. Irwin Goldman was natty and apparently sweatless in a cashmere topcoat in spite of the 60-degree temperatures. He went over to the Avis desk to check his car in while Dory Goldman sat with Rachel and Ellie. Lewis and Goldman joined the others at the same time. Lewis was a bit afraid that there might be a reprise of the My Son playlet, but he was spared. Goldman contented himself with a rather limp handshake and a muttered hello. The quick, embarrassed glance he afforded his son-in-law confirmed the certainty Lewis had awakened with this morning. The man must have been drunk. They went upstairs in the escalator and sat in the boarding lounge, not talking much. Dory Goldman thumbed nervously at her copy of an Erica Jong novel, but did not open it. She kept glancing a little nervously at the picture Ellie was holding. Lewis asked his daughter if she would like to walk over to the bookstore with him and pick out something to read on the plane. Ellie had been looking at him in that speculative way again. Lewis didn't like it. It made him nervous.
"Will you be good at Grandma and Grandas?" he asked her as they walked over.
"Yes," she said. "Daddy, will the truant officer get me? Andy Passioka says there's a truant officer, and he gets school skippers."
"Don't you worry about the truant officer," he said. "I'll take care of the school, and you can start again in the fall with no trouble."
"I hope I'll be okay in the fall," Ellie said. "I never was in a grade before, only kindergarten. I don't know what kids do in grades."
"Homework, probably."
"You'll be fine."
"Daddy, are you still pissed off at Grandpa?"
He gaped at her. "Why in the world would you think I was... that I didn't like your Grandpa, Ellie?" She shrugged as if the topic held no particular interest for her.
"When you talk about him, you always look pissed off."
"Ellie, that's vulgar."
"Sorry."
She gave him that strange fey look, and then drifted off to look at the racks of kid books. Mercer Meyer and Marie Sendak and Richard Scarry and Beatrix Potter, and that famous old standby, Dr. Seuss. How do they find this stuff out? Or do they just know? How much does Ellie know? How's it affecting her? "Ellie, what's behind that pale little face?" "Pissed off at him, Christ."
"Can I have these, Daddy?"
She was holding out a Dr. Seuss and a book Lewis hadn't seen since his own childhood. The story of Little Black Sambo and how the tigers had gotten his clothes one fine day. "I thought they'd made that one an unbook," Lewis thought, bemused. "Yes," he said, and they stood in a short line at the cash register. "Your grandpa and I like each other fine," he said, and thought again of his mother's story of how when a woman really wanted a baby, she found one. He remembered his own foolish promises to himself that he would never lie to his own children. Over the last few days, he had developed into quite a promising liar, he felt, but he would not let himself think about it now.
"Oh,"
she said and fell silent. The silence made him uneasy. To break it, he said, "So do you think you'll have a good time in Chicago?"
"No."
"No?
Why not?"
She looked up at him with that fey expression.
"I'm scared."
He put his hand on her head.
"Scared? Honey, what for? You're not scared of the plane, are you?"
"No," she said. "I don't know what I'm scared of. Daddy, I dreamed we were at Gage's funeral, and the funeral man opened his coffin, and it was empty. Then I dreamed I was home, and I looked in Gage's crib, and that was empty, too. But there was dirt in it."
"Lazarus, come forth."
For the first time in months, he remembered the dream he had had after Pascal's death. The dream, and then waking up to find his feet dirty, and the foot of the bed caked with pine needles and muck. The hairs at the nape of his neck stirred. "Just dreams," he said to Ellie, and his voice sounded, to his ears at least, perfectly normal.
They'll pass.
I wish you were coming with us, she said, or that we were staying here. Can we stay, Daddy, please? I don't want to go to Grandma and Grandas. I just want to go back to school, okay?
Just for a little while, Ellie, he said. I've got... He swallowed. A few things to do here, and then I'll be with you. We can decide what to do next.
He expected an argument, perhaps even an Ellie-style tantrum. He might even have welcomed it, a known quantity, as that look was not. But there was only that pallid, disquieting silence which seemed so deep. He could have asked her more, but found he didn't dare. She'd already told him more than he perhaps wanted to hear. Shortly after he and Ellie returned to the boarding lounge, the flight was called. Boarding passes were produced, and the four of them got in line. Lewis embraced his wife and kissed her hard. She clung to him for a moment and then let him go so he could pick Ellie up and buss her cheek. Ellie gazed at him solemnly with her Sybil's eyes. I don't want to go, she said again, but so low only Lewis could really hear over the shuffle and murmur of the boarding passengers. I don't want Mommy to go either.
Ellie, come on, Lewis said. You'll be fine.
I'll be fine, she said. But what about you? Daddy, what about you?
The line had begun to move now. People were walking down the jetway to the 727. Rachel pulled Ellie's hand, and for a moment she resisted holding up the line, her eyes fixed on her father. And Lewis found himself remembering her impatience last time, her cries of, come on, come on, come on.
Daddy?
Go now, Ellie. Please.
Rachel looked at Ellie and saw that dark, dreamy look for the first time.
Ellie?
She said, startled, and Lewis thought, a little afraid.
You're holding up the line, baby.
Ellie's lips trembled and grew white. Then she allowed herself to be led into the jetway. She looked back at him, and he saw naked terror in her face. He raised his hand to her in false cheeriness. Ellie did not wave back. 44. As Lewis left the BIA terminal building, a cold cloak fell over his mind. He became aware that he meant to go through with this. His mind, which had been sharp enough to get him through med school mostly on a scholarship, and what his wife could earn pushing coffee and Danish on the 5 to 11 a.m. shift 6 days a week, had taken the problem over and broken it down into components, as if this was just another prelim, the biggest one he had ever taken. And he intended to pass it with an A+, 100%. He drove to Brewer, the little city across the Penobscot River from Bangor. He found a parking spot across the street from Watson's Hardware.
Can I help you? The clerk asked.
Yes, Lewis said. I'd like a heavy flashlight, one of the square ones, and something I can hood it with. The clerk was a small, slim man with a high forehead and sharp eyes. He smiled now, but his smile was not particularly pleasant.
Going jacking, good buddy?
I beg your pardon.
Gonna jacklight a few deer tonight?
Not at all, Lewis said, unsmiling. I haven't a license to jack. The clerk blinked, and then decided to laugh.
In other words, mind my own business, huh?
Well, look, you can't hood one of those big lights, but you can get a piece of felt and poke a hole in the middle of it. Cut the beam down to a penlight.
That sounds fine, Lewis said. Thanks.
Surely. Anything else for you today?
Yes, indeed, Lewis said. I need a pick, a shovel, and a spade.
Short-handled shovel, long-handled spade, a stout length of rope 8 feet long, a pair of work gloves, a canvas tarpaulin, maybe 8x8.
I can do all that, the clerk said.
I've got a septic tank to dig up, Lewis said. It looks like I'm in violation of the zoning ordinances, and I've got some very nosy neighbors. I don't know if hooding my light will do any good or not, but I thought I might give it a try. I could get a pretty good fine.
Uh-oh, the clerk said. Better get a clothespin for your nose while you're at it.
Lewis laughed dutifully. His purchases came to $58.60. He paid cash. As gas prices went up, they'd used the big station wagon less and less. For some time it had had a bad wheel bearing, but Lewis had kept putting off the repair job. This was partly because he didn't want to part with the $200 it was likely to cost, but mostly because it was a nuisance.
Now, when he could have really used the big old dinosaur, he didn't dare chance it. The Civic was a hatchback, and Lewis was nervous about going back to Ludlow with a pick, shovel, and spade in there. Judd Crandall's eyes were sharp, and there was nothing wrong with his brains, either. He would know what was up. Then it occurred to him that there was no real reason to go back to Ludlow anyway. Lewis recrossed the Chamberlain Bridge into Bangor and checked into the Howard Johnson's Motor Lodge on the Odlin Road, once again near the airport, once again near Pleasant View Cemetery, where his son was buried. He checked in under the name of D.D. Ramon and paid cash for his room. He tried to nap, reasoning that he would be glad of the rest before tomorrow morning. In the words of some Victorian novel or other, there was wild work ahead of him tonight. Enough wild work to last a lifetime. But his brain simply would not shut down. He lay on the anonymous motel bed beneath a nondescript motel print of picturesque boats at dock beside a picturesque old wharf in a picturesque New England harbor, fully dressed except for his shoes, his wallet, coins, and keys on the night table beside him, his hands behind his head. That feeling of coldness still held. He felt totally unplugged from his people, the places that had become so familiar to him, even his work. This could have been any Howard Johnson's in the world, in San Diego or Duluth or Bangkok or Charlotte Amalia. He was nowhere, and now and then a thought of surpassing oddity struck him. Before he saw any of those familiar places and faces again, he would see his son. His plan kept unreeling in his mind. He looked at it from all angles, poked it, prodded it, looked for holes or soft places, and he felt that in truth he was walking along a narrow beam over a gulf of insanity. Madness was all around him, softly fluttering as the wings of night-hunting owls with great golden eyes. He was heading into madness. The voice of Tom Rush echoed dreamily in his head. "O Death, your hands are clammy. I feel them on my knees. You came and took my mother. Won't you come back after me?" Madness. Madness all around, close, hunting him. He walked the balance beam of rationality. He studied his plan. Tonight, around 11 o'clock, he would dig up his son's grave, remove the body from the coffin in which it lay, wrap Gage in a cut-down piece of the tarpaulin, and put it in the trunk of the Civic. He would replace the coffin and refill the grave. He would drive to Ludlow, take Gage's body from the trunk, and take a walk. Yes, he would take a walk. If Gage returned, the single path forked into two possibilities. Along one, he saw Gage returning as Gage, perhaps stunned or slow or even retarded. Only in the deepest recesses of his mind did Lewis allow himself to hope that Gage would return whole, and just as he had been. But surely even that was possible, wasn't it? But still, his son, Rachel's son, Ellie's brother. Along the other, he saw some sort of monster emerging from the woods behind the house. He had accepted so much that he did not balk at the idea of monsters, or even of demons, discorporeal beings of evil from the outer world, which might well take charge of a reanimated body from which the original soul had fled. Either way, he and his son would be alone. And he would... I will make a diagnosis. Yes, that is what he would do. I will make a diagnosis, not only of his body, but of his spirit. I will make allowances for the trauma of the accident itself, which he may or may not remember. Keeping the example of church before me, I will expect retardation, perhaps mild, perhaps profound. I will judge our ability to reintegrate Gage into our family on the basis of what I see over a period of from 24 to 72 hours. And if the loss is too great, or if he comes back as Timmy Baderman apparently came back, as a thing of evil, I will kill him. As a doctor, he felt he could kill Gage, if Gage was only the vessel containing some other being, quite easily. He would not allow himself to be swayed by its pleadings or its wiles. He would kill it as he would kill a rat carrying bubonic plague. There need be no melodrama about it. A pill in solution, perhaps two or three of them. If necessary, a shot. There was morphine in his bag. The following night, he would return the lifeless clay to Pleasant View and reinter it, simply trusting that his luck would hold a second time. "We don't even know if it will hold once," he reminded himself. He had considered the easier and safer alternative of the pet cemetery, but he would not have his son up there. There were a lot of reasons. The child burying his pet 5 years or 10 years or even 20 years later might stumble on the remains. That was one reason. But the most compelling one was simpler. The pet cemetery might be too close. The reinterment completed, he would fly to Chicago and join his family. Neither Rachel nor Ellie would ever need to know about his failed experiment. Then, looking along the other path, the path he hoped for blindly with all his love for his son, he and Gage would leave the house when the examination period was over, would leave at night. He would take certain papers with him and plan never to return to Ludlow again. He and Gage would check into a motel, perhaps this very one in which he now lay. The following morning he would cash every account they had, converting everything into American Express traveler's checks. "Don't leave home with your resurrected son without them," he thought. And flat cash. He and Gage would fly somewhere, Florida most likely. From there he would call Rachel, tell her where he was, tell her to take Ellie and catch a plane without telling her mother and father where she was going. Lewis believed he could convince her to do this. "Ask no questions, Rachel. Just come. Come now. This minute." He would tell her where they were staying. Some motel. She and Ellie would arrive in a rental car. He would bring Gage to the door when they knocked. Perhaps Gage would be wearing a bathing suit. And then... but beyond that, he did not dare go. Instead, he turned back to the plan's beginning and began to go over it again. He supposed that if things worked out, it had been accumulating the identification minutiae of whole new lives, so that Irwin Goldman could not use his overflowing checkbook to trace them. Such things could be done. Vaguely, he remembered arriving at the Ludlow house, tense, tired, and more than a little scared, and having some fantasy about just driving down to Orlando and hiring on as a medic at Disney World. Maybe that wasn't so far-fetched after all. He saw himself, dressed in white, resuscitating a pregnant woman who had foolishly gone on the Magic Mountain ride and had fainted. "Stand back, stand back, give her some air," he heard himself saying. And the woman opened her eyes and smiled gratefully at him. As his mind spun out this not disagreeable fantasy, Lewis fell asleep. He slept as his daughter awoke in an airplane somewhere above Niagara Falls, screaming from a nightmare of clutching hands and stupid yet merciless eyes. He slept as the stewardess rushed down the aisle to see what was wrong. He slept as Rachel, totally unnerved, tried to soothe her. He slept as Ellie cried over and over again, "It's Gage! Mommy, it's Gage! It's Gage! Gage is alive! Gage has got the knife from Daddy's bag! Don't let him get me! Don't let him get Daddy!" He slept as Ellie quieted at last and lay shuddering against her mother's breast, her eyes wide and tearless, and as Dory Goldman thought what an awful thing all of this had been for Eileen, and how much she reminded Dory of Rachel after Zelda had died. He slept and woke up at 5:15, with the afternoon light beginning to slant down toward the coming night. "Wild work," he thought stupidly and got up. 45. By the time United Airlines Flight 419 touched down at O'Hare Airport and offloaded its passengers at 3:10 Central Standard Time, Ellie Creed was in a state of low hysteria, and Rachel was very frightened. If you touched Ellie casually on the shoulder, she jumped and stared around at you with big wall eyes, and her whole body quivered steadily and without let-up. It was as if she were full of electricity. The nightmare on the airplane had been bad enough, but this... Rachel simply didn't know how to cope with it. Going into the terminal, Ellie tripped over her own feet and fell down. She did not get up, but merely lay there on the carpet with people passing around her, or looking down at her with that mildly sympathetic but disconnected glance of people who are in transit and cannot be bothered, until Rachel picked her up in her arms. "Ellie, what's wrong with you?" Rachel asked. But Ellie would not answer. They moved across the lobby
toward the luggage carousels, and Rachel saw her mother and father waiting there for them. She waved at them with her free hand, and they came over. "They told us not to go to the gate and wait for you," Doris said. "So we thought..." "Rachel? How's Eileen?"
"Not good."
"Is there a ladies' room, Mommy? I'm going to throw up."
"Oh, God," Rachel said despairingly and took her by the hand. There was a ladies' room across the lobby, and she led Ellie toward it quickly.
"Rachel, shall I come?" Dory called. "No, get the luggage. You know what it looks like. We're okay."
Mercifully, the ladies' room was deserted. Rachel led Ellie to one of the stalls, fumbling in her purse for a dime, and then she saw, thank God, that the locks on three of them were broken. Over one broken lock, someone had written in grease pencil, "Sir John Crapper was a sexist pig." Rachel pulled the door open quickly. Ellie was now moaning and holding her stomach. She retched twice, but there was no vomiting. They were the dry heaves of total nervous exhaustion. When Ellie told her she felt a little better, Rachel took her over to the basins and washed her daughter's face. Ellie was wretchedly white, and there were circles under her eyes.
"Ellie, what is wrong? Can't you tell me?"
"I don't know what's wrong," she said. "But I knew something was wrong ever since Daddy told me about the trip. Because something was wrong with him."
"Louis, what are you hiding? You were hiding something. I could see it. Even Ellie could see it."
It occurred to her that she had also been nervous all day, as though waiting for a blow to fall. She felt the way she did in the 2 or 3 days before her period, tense and on edge, ready to laugh or cry or get a headache that would come bulleting through like a fast express, there and then gone 3 hours later.
"What?"
she said now to Ellie's reflection in the mirror.
"Honey, what could be wrong with Daddy?"
"I don't know," Ellie said. "It was the dream. Something about Gage. Or maybe it was church. I don't remember. I don't know."
"Ellie, what was your dream?"
"I dreamed I was in the pet cemetery," Ellie said. "Paxcal took me to the pet cemetery and said Daddy was going to go there and something terrible was going to happen."
"Paxcal?"
A bolt of terror, both sharp and yet undefined, struck her. What was that name, and why did it seem familiar? It seemed that she had heard that name, or one like it, but she could not for the life of her remember where.
"You dreamed someone named Paxcal took you to the pet cemetery?"
"Yes. That's what he said his name was, and..."
Her eyes suddenly widened. "Do you remember something else?"
"He said that he was sent to warn, but that he couldn't interfere. He said that he was, I don't know, that he was near Daddy because they were together when his soul was dis... I can't remember," she wailed.
"Honey," Rachel said, "I think you dreamed about the pet cemetery because you're still thinking about Gage, and I'm sure Daddy is fine. Do you feel any better now?"
"No,"
Ellie whispered. "Mommy, I'm scared. Aren't you scared?"
"Uh-uh," Rachel said, with a brisk little shake of her head and a smile. But she was. She was scared. And that name, Paxcal, haunted her with its familiarity. She felt she had heard it in some dreadful context months or even years ago, and that nervy feeling would not leave her. She felt something. Something pregnant, swollen, and waiting to burst. Something terrible that needed to be averted. But what? What?
"I'm sure everything is fine," she told Ellie. "Want to go back to Grandma and Grandpa?"
"I guess so," Ellie said listlessly. The Puerto Rican woman led her very young son into the ladies, scolding him. A large wet stain had spread on the crotch of the little boy's Bermudas, and Rachel found herself reminded of Gage with a kind of paralyzing poignancy. This fresh sorrow was like Novocaine, smothering her jitters.
"Come on," she said. "We'll call Daddy from Grandpa's house."
"He was wearing shorts," Ellie said suddenly, looking back at the little boy.
"Who was, honey?"
"Paxcal," Ellie said. "He was wearing red shorts in my dream." That brought the name momentarily into focus, and Rachel felt that knee-weakening fear again. Then it danced away. They could not get close to the luggage carousel. Rachel could just see the top of her father's hat, the one with the feather. Dory Goldman was holding two seats against the wall for them, and waving. Rachel brought Ellie over. "Are you feeling any better, dear?" Dory asked. "A little bit," Ellie said. "Mommy..." She turned to Rachel and broke off. Rachel was sitting bolt upright, her hand clapped to her mouth, her face white. She had it. It had suddenly gone through with a terrible thud. Of course she should have known at once, but she had tried to put it out of her mind. "Of course."
"Mommy?"
Rachel turned slowly to her daughter, and Ellie could hear the tendons in her neck creak. She took her hand away from her mouth.
"Did the man in your dream tell you his first name, Eileen?" "Mommy, are you all... Did the man in your dream tell you his first name?"
Dory was looking at her daughter and granddaughter as if they might have both gone crazy.
"Yes, but I can't remember. Mommy, you're hurting me."
Rachel looked down and saw that her free hand was clamped around Ellie's lower forearm like a manacle.
"Was it Victor?"
Ellie drew sharp breath.
"Yes, Victor. He said his name was Victor. Mommy, did you dream of him, too?"
"Not Paxcow," Rachel said.
"Pascal." "That's what I said, Paxcow."
"Rachel, what's wrong?" Dory said. She took Rachel's free hand and winced at its chill.
"And what's wrong with Eileen?"
"It's not Eileen," Rachel said. "It's Lewis, I think. Something is wrong with Lewis. Or something is going to be wrong. Sit with Ellie, Mom. I want to call home." She got up and crossed to the telephones, digging in her purse for a quarter. She made the call collect, but there was no one to accept the charges. The phone simply rang. "Will you try your call later?" the operator asked her.
"Yes,"
Rachel said and hung up. She stood there, staring at the phone.
"He said that he was sent to warn, but that he couldn't interfere. He said that he was near Daddy because they were together when his soul was I can't remember."
"Discorporated," Rachel whispered. Her fingers dug at the fabric of her handbag. "Oh, my God, was that the word?" She tried to catch at her thoughts, to arrange them. Was something going on here, something beyond their natural upset at Gage's death, and this queer cross-country trip that was so much like flight? How much had Ellie known about the young man who had died on Lewis's first day at work?
"Nothing," her mind answered inexorably. "You kept it from her, the way you tried to keep anything from her that had to do with death, even the possible death of her cat. Remember the dumb, stupid argument we had that day in the pantry? You kept it from her because you were scared then and you're scared now. His name was Pascal, Victor Pascal. And how desperate is the situation now, Rachel? How bad is this? What in the name of God is happening?"
Her hands were trembling so badly that it took her two tries to redeposit her quarter. This time she called the infirmary at the university and got Charlton, who accepted the call, a little mystified. No, she hadn't seen Lewis, and would have been surprised if he had come in today. That said, she offered her sympathies to Rachel again. Rachel accepted them, and then asked Charlton to have Lewis call her at her folks' house if he did come in. "Yes, he had the number," she answered Charlton's question, not wanting to tell the nurse, who probably knew anyway. She had a feeling that Charlton didn't miss much, that her folks' house was half the continent away. She hung up, feeling hot and trembly. "She heard Pascal's name somewhere else, that's all. My God, you don't raise a kid in a glass box like a hamster or something. She heard an item about it on the radio, or some kid mentioned it to her at school, and her mind stored it away. Even that word she couldn't say. Suppose it was a jawbreaker like discorporated or discorporeal. So what? That proves nothing except that the subconscious is exactly the kind of sticky flypaper the Sunday supplements say it is." She remembered a college psych instructor who had asserted that under the right conditions, your memory could play back the names of every person to whom you had ever been introduced, every meal you had ever eaten, the weather conditions which had obtained on every day of your life. He made a persuasive case for this incredible assertion, telling them that the human mind was a computer with staggering numbers of memory chips, not 16K or 32K or 64K, but perhaps as much as 1 billion K, literally 1,000 billion. And how much might each of these organic chips be capable of storing? No one knew. But there were so many of them, he said, that there was no need for any of them to be erasable so they could be reused. In fact, the conscious mind had to turn down the lights on some of them as a protection against informational insanity. You might not be able to remember where you keep your socks, the psych instructor had said. If the entire contents of the Encyclopedia Britannica was stored in the adjacent two or three memory cells. This had produced dutiful laughter from the class. But this wasn't a psych class under good fluorescent lights with all that comforting jargon written on the board and some smart-ass assistant prof cheerfully blue-skying his way through the last 15 minutes of the period. Something is dreadfully wrong here, and you know it. You feel it. I don't know what it has to do with Pascal, or Gage, or Church, but it has something to do with Lewis. What? Is it? Suddenly a thought as cold as a handful of jelly struck her. She picked up the telephone receiver again and groped in the coin return for her dime. Was Lewis contemplating suicide? Was that why he had gotten rid of them, nearly pushed them out the door? Had Ellie somehow had fuck psychology. Had she had a psychic flash of some sort? This time, she made the call collect to Judd Crandall. It rang 5 times. 6. 7. She was about to hang up when his voice, breathless, answered, "Hello? Judd. Judd, this is..." "Just a minute, ma'am," the operator said. "Will you accept a collect call from Mrs. Lewis Creed?" "Yeah," Judd said. "Pardon, sir, is that yes or no?" "I guess I will," Judd said. There was a doubtful pause as the operator translated Yankee into American. Then, "Thank you." "Go ahead, ma'am." "Judd, have you seen Lewis today?"
"Today? I can't say I have, Rachel. But I was away to Brewer this morning, getting my groceries. Been out in the garden this afternoon, behind the house."
"Why?" "Oh, it's probably nothing, but Ellie had a bad dream on the plane, and I just thought I'd set her mind at ease if I could."
"Plane?"
Judd's voice seemed to sharpen a trifle.
"Where are you, Rachel?"
"Chicago," she said. "Ellie and I came back to spend some time with my parents."
"Lewis didn't go with you?"
"He's going to join us by the end of the week," Rachel said. And now it was a struggle to keep her voice even. There was something in Judd's voice she didn't like.
"Was it his idea that you should go out there?"
"Well, yes." "Judd, what's wrong? Something is wrong, isn't it? And you know something about it."
"Maybe you ought to tell me the child's dream," Judd said after a long pause. "I wish you would."